But with that, we have a special guest speaker, Brother Tim Barton. He's a fellow SAGU graduate, which I appreciate. But he's going to bring the word, and it's an awesome message this morning. And then after the service, we encourage you, if you're free, we have lots of things set up outside, a picnic to celebrate our Founders Day and some inflatables and things, and we would love to spend that time with you. But without further ado, Brother Tim Barton.
Well, it's my pleasure to be back again. If you aren't familiar, I work for an organization called Wall Builders. We are from Texas, and sometimes people get confused by having the name Wall Builders in Texas. We don't build walls. It's quite confusing, although not that I'm against a southern border wall, but that's not what we do. We took the Bible name and the Bible story of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah, if you remember, was the one that, part of the Babylonian captivity, he was a cupbearer to the king, and he was so burdened by seeing Jerusalem. His nation had been torn down, and God laid on his heart the burden to rebuild his nation, to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. We started back in the 80s. My dad was the one that started Wall Builders and really kind of birthed from this story of Nehemiah, that he wanted to help rebuild and restore the religious, the moral foundations of the nation. And so we have spent the last 40 approximate years studying American history. We have what's considered the largest private collection of original documents from the founding era, and we're able to document the impact and influence of Christianity on the founding of America from original writings. So I want to take you on a little bit of a journey through that this morning. I'm going to start with something from John Adams. In 1813, he wrote Thomas Jefferson a letter, and at this point, they're elderly men. Relatively speaking, for that time especially. And he says, remember all those years ago, like 40 years earlier, we were together, we were doing the Declaration of Independence. And he's reminding him in this letter of when they first got together, the founding fathers didn't know each other. They didn't agree on many things. And he pointed out, we were so divided on our sentiments. He said, but we found common ground. And in the letter where he says they found common ground, he says, the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Now, it's really interesting that he says the thing that brought us together in the midst of all our disagreements were the principles of Christianity. Well, today, right, if you're studying American history today, I was just with somebody yesterday, and he said, well, yeah, but we know the founding fathers, they were all deists. We hear a lot of these thoughts in modern education that our nation was a secular nation. The founding fathers didn't believe in God. But if you go back prior to the last 60 years, the way the story's been told, if you go back and look at early evidences, there was a historian from Duke University, her name was Alice Baldwin, back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. She wrote a book called The New England Clergy and the American Revolution, and she pointed out, if you look at the issues in the Declaration, every single issue in the Declaration, she points out, had been preached from American pulpits prior to 1763. So what she explained is when the founding fathers got together and they're trying to find common ground, what are we going to do? The ideas they came up with that we eventually find in the Declaration, it actually wasn't their ideas they were coming up with. They were repeating the things they had heard from their pastor the last two decades. Now, again, this is a different story than we hear today. And so how do we get this idea that the founding fathers were influenced by their pastors? I want to point out, if we actually just would take time and read and study the story, we would recognize how true this sentiment is, because the very first time the founding fathers ever got together, it was September 6, 1774. That was the first meeting of the First Continental Congress. And when they come together, they had never met each other before. So like Patrick Henry, he's never met Sam or John Adams. He doesn't know who they are. They're meeting for the very first time, and the opening motion, they get together, all the delegation, and this is political people meeting. The very first motion made of the meeting was that they should open with prayer. And they discussed it from one. In fact, John Adams, one of the delegates who was there, this was the painting done depicting that first prayer that happened. But John Adams, he talked about that Thomas Cushing made the first motion, and it was that we should open with prayer. And we discussed it, and then it was agreed upon. And so they called for the local pastor, the Reverend Jacob Duché. He's the one standing behind the pulpit there. And this is in the records of Congress. Now, I'm telling you that because you don't need to take my word for this. This is in the records of Congress. The opening prayer lasted for 2 hours. I don't know how spiritual you feel this morning, right? I love Jesus a lot, but if I showed up somewhere and they're like, we're going to pray the next 2 hours, I'd be like, whew, right? Like, I mean, Jesus and I hang out all the time, but 2 hours, like, I need to mentally prepare myself for that moment, right? This is the way Congress first started. And actually, the records of Congress identify that in the midst of their time of prayer, somebody suggested, hey, maybe we should read some Bible verses as well. So they went to the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, which was written back in the 1600s. They were, at that time where they were, that the minister leading them was an Anglican, and so he pulls out the Book of Common Prayer, and he says, well, the chapters assigned for today, because it's like a Bible reading plan. Every day you had different chapters you would read. He said, well, the chapters assigned for today are these four chapters. Well, of those four chapters, John Adams points out that as they were reading, he says, one of those chapters was incredibly applicable to our situation. Another founding father said that that chapter was accidentally extremely applicable to our situation, meaning they didn't try to find a really relevant verse for them, but they read something that day. It was Psalm 35 specifically, and part of what John Adams wrote to Abigail from that day, he said, I must beg you to read that psalm. Read the 35th psalm to your friends. Read it to your father. He says, everybody needs to read what we just read. Well, Psalm 35 is one of the psalms that David wrote as he was fleeing from King Saul. King Saul's chasing him down, and David writes and says, God, I've done nothing, and yet he seeks my destruction. Lord, you raise up. You be my shield, my buckler, my strong right arm. And on it goes for 30-something verses. Well, they had found out, when they were there in that meeting, they found out that the night before that Boston had come under attack by the British. The British had blockaded the harbor. They began bombing and cannonading into Boston. And so their own nation is starting to attack them, and they're going, what do we do? And that actually makes a little more sense. Somebody's like, we should open with prayer. We should ask God for help. And then as they're reading the Bible in the midst of this two-hour prayer meeting, they read Psalm 35, and they're like, oh, we are David. Right? Like, this is us, God. Yes, you rise up, be our shield, our buckler. What's interesting is John Adams then writes a subsequent letter, and he tells Abigail what else they just did. He says, we've appointed a continental fast. And this is the Continental Congress. The founding fathers, one of the first moves they make as leaders, political leaders together, is they call for a day of prayer. And actually, John Adams in this letter said millions would be upon their knees at once before their great creator, imploring his forgiveness and blessing, his smile on American council and arms. He's telling Abigail, right, this is going to be amazing. Millions of people are going to be on their knees praying. There's only about 3 million colonists at that time. So the idea that millions of people are praying, he's assuming that everybody's going to pray. Now, I think that's probably naive. I think probably not everybody prayed, but this is the way he views it. And this idea of calling on people to pray, this wasn't a new idea, and this wasn't like a one-off scenario, because if you go forward from this moment, by 1815, there'd been more than 1,400 official prayer proclamations issued by government leaders, whether it be governors or presidents or even Congress. Now again, why does this matter? Because today, it's not unusual that someone says, yeah, but the founding fathers were atheists or agnostics or deists, or they believed in a separation of church and state, right? They wanted a secular government. And anytime I hear people make that statement, this is the number one thing I like to ask about. If they were atheists, agnostics, or deists, then here's my question. Then why did they pray all the time? Like, I think you've confused what an atheist, agnostic, and deist is, because an atheist believes there's no God. An agnostic believes that there's no way to know for sure if there's a God, and a deist believes there is a God, but that he doesn't get involved in our world. It's like the clockmaker theory of God, that God wound the world up and let it go. If you're an atheist, agnostic, and deist, you're definitely not doing these prayer proclamations. Also, the fact that these came from governors or presidents or Congress, that wouldn't come if they believed in a separation of church and state the way that we understand it. Now, the problem is today, we understand the separation of church and state as the secularization of the state from the church. Back then, they just believed in having separate institutions. Because if you read your Bible, by the way, God gave Moses all of the laws for the new nation of Israel. And God put Aaron over the tabernacle. Those are separate institutions. They're not secular institutions. We have misunderstood this, but let me back up. The first Congress, when they do this first prayer proclamation, actually through the Revolution, they did 15 of these proclamations, and there were two different kinds of proclamations. The first one was for prayer and fasting, and this is not surprising. If you know you need God's help and you need God's intervention, you need to get serious. Take time, pray and fast about this. And then, after you've prayed and fast, if you believe that God has moved on your behalf, what is the logical response? Well, you need to have some time to pray and thank God for what God has done. Throughout the Revolution, 15 times this sequence went. They would have a day of prayer and fasting, calling all the colonies to pray and fast. And then a couple months later, they had a day of prayer and thanksgiving, saying, we need to thank God for what God did. Well, the very first proclamation Congress issued, again, not surprising, was prayer and fasting. And it wasn't very long after that they had issued this call for prayer and fasting. John Adams writes Abigail another letter. And I'm referencing a lot of John Adams' letters on purpose because I want to make it very easy. If anybody is questioning and like, I want to see these, good. Go read the letters between John and Abigail. From the American Revolution to the end of their life, they wrote 1,100 letters back and forth. And that's a lot of letters. And there's a couple of volumes of books now that are just their letters. Also, if you are someone who, if you like Hallmark movies, you would love these letters. Okay? Because they are hopeless romantics. And I mean, really, John Adams at times, it's a little thick. If you read some of his letters, you're like, that's a terrible line from a Hallmark movie. He has a letter where he starts off and says, Abigail, I'm suffocating because I haven't seen you in a week and a half and you are the air that I breathe. Right. Right, ladies? That said, oh, you love Hallmark, right? I'm with you. I got you. But literally, like if I saw that on a Hallmark movie, I'd be like, that's a terrible line. Nobody says that in real life. He did, right? Like this is that guy. But I'm telling you this because this is all recorded stuff. Okay, documented. John Adams writes Abigail, says, Abigail, it's amazing what just happened. He says, our men are militias, and he starts naming a couple towns. He says, they were able to repel the British, and we protected the towns and the forts. And then he goes on, and he says, we've just destroyed a 64-gun British man of warship and a 20-gun British man of warship. Now, those are naval vessels that are designed for war, and one had 64 cannons, one had 20 cannons. Why is that impressive? Because we didn't have a navy yet. When we separate from Great Britain, we had always been British citizens. So the British military was our military, and the British military was the number one military in the world. And arguably, they were the number one in the world because they had the number one navy in the world. When we separate, the navy is the British navy. It's not our navy, so we don't have any war vessels. There were businessmen in America, and they did have some trade vessels. So what we began to do, we took whatever boats we had. We took whatever cannons we could find, we'd put the cannons on the boats, and we would use them to try to fight back. And John Adams says, we just destroyed a British naval vessel with 64 cannons, one with 20 cannons. Again, why does that really matter? Well, if you ever go to Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian Museum of American History, up on the third floor has one of the very first ships of the American Navy. It's called the Gunboat Philadelphia. This is the Gunboat Philadelphia. He says, Abigail, it's amazing. We just destroyed two ships, right? And you're like, how? Did you row really fast in their direction? Right? Like, this makes no sense at all. It didn't make sense. And people begin to recognize some of what's happening right now doesn't really make sense. In fact, there's a following letter where John Adams writes back to Abigail, and he says, Abigail, I was eating dinner tonight. This is when he's away at Congress. He said, I was eating dinner tonight, and there were men at a table behind me, and they were talking about all of these unlikely things we've been seeing happen, and they were trying to come up with the best explanation for what's going on. He says, and I think what they concluded is the best explanation there is for what we're seeing. Well, here's what they concluded, he wrote Abigail. It appears to me the eternal Son of God is operating powerfully against the British nation. What does that mean? They're going, how do we explain this? And somebody's like, I know, it's Jesus, right? It's the only way. And John Adams is like, this is the one that makes the most sense. Now, again, why would they think this? Because they were seeing things happen that did not make any sense unless it was God intervening on their behalf. Okay, now, this letter was in 1777, so this is still early phases of the revolution. What are they already seeing at this point that has so convinced them that God's on their side? Let me take you back through a couple of these moments and tell you a few of these stories. If you go back, for example, to August of 1776, this is a month and a half, 2 months after the Declaration, you have what's known as the Battle of Long Island, or it's also known as the Battle of Brooklyn Heights. In this battle, the British have arrived. There's more than 30,000 British. This is a painting done by a British military historian depicting what happened. There's 30,000 British up against 9,000 Americans. This is on New York. They're on an island. The British begin advancing. The Americans get pinned back against the river. And this is an era in American history when most people did not know how to swim. So they are stuck by the water, and it's a mile to the other side of the river, which would be a really hard, long swim anyway. And so Washington and his 9,000 troops are pinned down. And as the British have them pinned down, they have a pause, which historians debate why they might have paused. But one of the things that I think makes sense, one of the reasons they would have paused is because they sent word to the British Navy to send a fleet, and a fleet of vessels showed up and began sailing up the river behind Washington. And Washington recognizes, we're going to be fully surrounded, and at that point, we're going to largely be done. Because even though oftentimes we romanticize on some level, especially like the prowess of the American military. Okay, I have no problem acknowledging America as the number one military in the world. We're awesome. We're great. Sure. Let me back you up in time. Okay, this is an era where we're shooting single shot muskets, not rifles, right? And the Americans have never really done this before. So the fact that they're outnumbered 3-1, this is significant. It's not going to go well for them. Washington knows. He says, we're all going to be captured or killed. But an interesting thing then happens. This is the first of the unlikely events. As the British Navy is sailing up the river, a storm blew in from out of nowhere. And the storm was so severe that the British Navy had to recall their vessels because they didn't want them to run aground or run into rocks in this river. So they called their vessels back out. Washington realizes, if those ships finally, when the storm calms and they make it up, we will be pinned, we're trapped, we're going to be captured or killed. He said, we have to get off this island tonight. Well, it's also significant that night the storm calmed. Because had the storm been raging, it would have been very challenging for them to get off. Washington says, find anything that floats, and we're going to use it. And so they start looking. They find some canoes. They find these flat-bottom boats, like these John boats. And they begin the evacuation of 9,000 men that night. Well, there's only so many men you're getting in a canoe at a time. It's a mile across and a mile back, and so this evacuation going all night, they get about 8,000 men off by the time the dawn of the next morning is beginning to appear. And Washington has remained behind. It was reported that he said he's going to be the last one off the island, and you can imagine, some of his officers were going, sir, we got to get you off. And he said, that's not the kind of leader I am. I'm not going to abandon my men in this really dark hour. I'm going to make sure my men are okay, and then I'm leaving. And again, you can imagine the conversations with like, sir, we can afford to lose some privates. We can't lose our general, right? You're more important right now. But he remained behind. So the morning is coming. You have 1,000 men, the commander of the Continental Army that's still there, and now it's 30,000 to 1,000. And as soon as the light of dawn appears, the British are going to recognize, hey, they're evacuating, they're going to advance, and then those 1,000 men are going to be captured. George Washington, for sure, is going to be executed for leading this treasonous rebellion. But before it got very light, another unusual thing happened. Off of the river, a fog rose, and the fog came, and it sat between both camps. The fog, and if you have not read the story of Exodus recently, maybe go back and remember like Moses, Red Sea, Pharaoh's army, because when you read the story of the American Revolution and the Battle of Long Island, you're like, that seems kind of familiar. Yes, it does. This is not the first time we've seen God do these kinds of miracles, but one of the guys who was there, Major Benjamin Talmadge, he became the head of what was known as the Cole Perspiring. There were many spirings in the Revolution, the Cole Perspiring being probably the most famous. He's the guy that leads it. Well, he wrote about that morning. He said, a very dense fog began to rise and it seemed to settle in a peculiar manner over both encampments. I recollect this peculiar providential occurrence perfectly well. And so very dense was the atmosphere that I could scarcely discern a man at 6 yards distance. So right from me to the front row, he's like, you couldn't even see somebody at that distance. Well, the fog sat between both camps. So they continue the evacuation. When the last 3 boats were loaded, they get to the middle of the river. And this is reported from the British side. The British see that the fog is lifting and they recognize the camp is empty. The British charge the camp seeing it's empty, and the British reported seeing 3 boats arriving on the other side and seeing them unload. Now, it's also kind of worth remembering, Washington said he's going to be the last one off the island. So they're probably watching George Washington unload on the other side, and they recognize, the Americans recognize, that we have survived and lived to fight another day. Now, they did not win this battle yet, but they recognized that could have gone really, really bad. And some unusual things happened. And as they begin to process, they're like, okay, what are the odds? We're outnumbered, right, 3-1, and British fleet's coming in, and a storm comes in out of nowhere. Like, crazy storm, and then evening comes, and as soon as it gets dark, the storm calms. We begin the evacuation, know we're making it in time, and then a fog rolls in. The fog stays until we get off to the other side, and the fog lifts. Like, well, that seems unusual. Yeah, that's kind of unusual. And if this would have been the only time that something like that happened, you might could have explained it away. You might could have said, these are just the luckiest people and military, like, stories there's ever been. You could have explained it if it only happened once. But they begin to see this kind of stuff happen over and over. And as they saw it happen time and again, they begin to think, you know, I don't think this is just a coincidence. I think something's happening. And let me take you through more of that story. Because from this, now, if you jump forward, this is just a couple months later, but in December, they are still at a place where all they have done is suffer defeats. So they have not started winning battles, largely speaking, yet. And from the Battle of Long Island, which they lose, they then lose the Battle of Kips Bay, they lose the Battle of White Plains, they lose the Battle of Fort Washington, they lose the Battle of Fort Lee, they lose all of New York. And part of why this is a problem, for many reasons, is back then they had 1 year enlistments. And all enlistments were up in December. So whether you're joining in January or you joined in March, April, May, June, whenever you join, that enlistment's up in December. And if we're in December and all we've done is lose the whole time, and Washington's like, guys, round two, come on, we can do it. As a Texan, it feels like being a Cowboys fan in the playoffs. Because you're like, why do we even try? We're just going to lose again. Right? Like, this is their reality, okay? Washington knows we have to change the dynamic of this conversation. So Washington, and again, keep in mind context. The morale is at an all-time low in the military. People are already deserting because they're going, hey, it's December, my enlistment's almost up. Why am I staying here where I'm cold when I can go home and be with my family, be on my farm, have a fire to keep me warm? And he's trying to get people on the list. Nobody wants to sign up. Nobody wants to repeat. No new people are coming in. This is Washington's dilemma. And so Washington says, we're going to do something different. We have to have a victory before the end of the year. And where they were stationed that winter for camp, one of the closest forts was Trenton, where there was Hessians that were watching that post. But Washington's idea, if you remember part of the story, this is where the famous crossing of the Delaware happens. Washington's idea was to go on Christmas night. Now, going on Christmas night was a strategic decision because, again, attacking the outposts where the Hessians were German mercenaries hired by the British to fight against the Americans. Well, the Germans, which also is, it's a side note, but it's kind of interesting. It's one of the reasons Christmas wasn't celebrated in America until almost the Civil War. Christmas was not allowed in most of the early Christian colonies because what they said is we have seen how over in Europe they have so commercialized this that it's not about Jesus anymore and we're not taking these secular holidays in America. Well, it's interesting, right? How would they commercialize them? Well, one of the things that were very well known about the Germans is the Germans would use any excuse to have a party. And so now also like military strategy, it's kind of a good idea. If you're like, hey, we know the men are going to be drinking. Let's show up the next morning when like drunk, hangover, headaches, that's a good time. That's probably a good military strategy. Attack the other guys when they're not really all with it. They don't feel good. This is Washington's idea. So Washington says, we're going to go on Trenton Christmas night. We're going to make the move. And his idea was they were going to have three different crossing locations of the Delaware. And as they're going to cross the three locations, he actually sent word to another troop that was north of Trenton to come down. So he's thinking we're going to have 7,000 to 8,000 men. There's between 1,200 and 1,500 Hessians that are going to be there is what their understanding is. So we're going to have this superior force and numerical advantage. We're going to win this fight. We're going to boost morale. People are going to be excited. Well, as this kind of unfolds, Washington is planning, we're going to be across the Delaware by midnight. And the guy actually who was in charge of the crossing where Washington and his men got across was General Henry Knox. And I'm going to come back to his name in a minute. I just want to point out he was there, and then we're going to read a letter from him in just a moment. But as they are going to go across, again, there were going to be three crossing locations of the Delaware. Of those three crossing locations, the estimation was about 5,400 troops are going to come across. That would include all of the cannons and the horses. But as they begin this, Washington doesn't know initially that two of the crossing locations, the weather was so bad, the ice flows were so bad that they could get no troops across. Washington doesn't know that yet, but the only place where any troops were able to get across is the area where Washington was. And as they begin crossing, conditions are so bad, they're delayed by ice flood. Only 2,400 troops get across, and they don't even get across till 4 a.m. Now, the reason this is a problem is once they got across, they still had a 9-mile march to get to Trenton, and they were going to be set up by between 5 and 6 a.m., so before it's really light outside, so they're going to be a surprise when they get there. Well, if you don't get across till 4 a.m., and you got a 9-mile march, you're not making a 9-mile march with 2,400 troops and cannons and horses and being in position before light gets there. But Washington knows that we have to make an advance. And also, this is when he gets a report that nobody else made it across. And he got the report that the troop from the north is not coming. So your 7,000 to 8,000 men is now 2,400 against what could be 1,500. So your numerical advantage has been shot, right? You don't have the superior force like you were thinking anymore. It's now much closer in what we're doing. But Washington says, we have to advance. We have to make a move. And so they decide we're going to continue on. So that night they advance on, knowing they're going to arrive late on this 9-mile march. In the midst of it, a blizzard rolls in on them. And this is also where, if you even go back to the British historians, they identify that they could track the movement of the American forces at wintertime by the bloody footprints in the snow. Because when people signed up in January through whenever June, when they sign up, you signed up with whatever clothes you were wearing. Well, back then, if you're signing up and it's not cold, you're not bringing your winter gear. And a lot of people didn't even have winter gear. And so they're showing up with whatever they have. By the time they've gone all these months wearing the same clothes, they've worn holes in them. They've worn them ragged. They've worn their boots out. And so many of the men have no boots. And some are trying to wrap their feet with some kind of sackcloth. That's not what I was going for, but knapsack kind of stuff is what they're wrapping their feet with, if they have anything. And so as they're walking in the snow, they're leaving bloody footprints. The British historians reported that. As they're doing this, you can imagine, if you're one of the Americans and you're like, I'm trying to do the right thing. God, what is going on? In the midst of them still making this march, Washington says, hey guys, we got to keep going. Two men actually froze to death during this march. Just to, again, perspective context of this. When you read the history books and some of the reports, it doesn't really specify what happened. My best guess is that two guys are like, hey, we're tired. Can we just have a rest for a second? And if you sit down and you're not properly dressed and it's a blizzard, you might not get back up. And that's what happened. Two guys died during this march. Well, what they did not know is because this blizzard was happening on their march, they're in close proximity to Trenton. The blizzard was happening in Trenton as well. And the guards that were on duty went to their CO, their commanding officer, and said, sir, surely nobody's crazy enough to be out doing operations in this kind of weather. Can we please come in and stay warm by their fire? And their commanding officer agreed. He said, yeah, nobody's moving in this weather. You guys come in and stay warm. So Washington and his men are not going to arrive before daylight. So there won't be a secrecy for them establishing position, getting close location. And yet, now the only people that would see them coming are not watching anymore. There's literally no guards on duty. So they march and they arrive, and when they get in position, generally if you are in position against somebody who is inside of a fort, they're in an entrenched position. That this could go a long time before you finally get the victory, except when they announced themselves, it was a complete surprise to the Hessians, and the Hessians didn't know what to do. They scatter outside of they abandoned the fort, trying to get a better flanking position, not knowing where the Americans really were, and because of the chaos of what happened, the battle lasted only 35 minutes. They had the entrenched position. Now, let me go further, because in the midst of it only lasting 35 minutes, remember the Hessians were fighting on Team British. They'd been hired by the British as mercenaries. On the British side, on Team British, there were approximately 20 killed, 100 wounded and 1,000 captured. On the American side, there were 3 wounded. Period. Again, this is where people are like, well, that's weird, right? Like, we went through all that, and it's 35 minutes, and like, with all of this, like, wounded and killed and captured, and only 3 of us. Oh, it gets even weirder. Because as they're making the advance, Washington sent a small detachment to go to the edge of Trenton on the road outside of town. He said, there might be loyalists in the town that if they see us advancing, they might send word and they might bring help. And we don't want reinforcements coming to help the Hessians. So Washington sends a small detachment to the edge of town to make sure that nobody can get out of town. Well, in this small detachment, there was a young officer. And he actually is one of the three that's wounded, but here's the story. As they're going to the edge of town, there was a dog that began barking in one house. And a man came to the house, opened the door, what's going on? And sees these American colonists wearing right their uniforms, and they explain, sir, we mean you no harm. You stay inside the house. We're just closing down the road. Nobody can leave right now. Well, what's going on? We're advancing on Trenton, and we're not letting people leave, but we're going to do you no harm. You stay in your house. And he says, no, I'm a patriot. He says, if something's going on, he says, I want to come. Well, the man, his name was John Riker, specifically Dr. John Riker. And what he said is, there may be some poor fellow that needs my assistance. So he grabbed his medical bag. He joined this small detachment. When the battle starts, the small detachment goes and they join the edge of Washington's forces. The officer that was in charge of the detachment, he was one of the three initially that was wounded. Well, then this young officer steps up because now he's the one leading in, and he gets shot through the shoulder and it goes into his chest, nicks an artery, and he starts bleeding out. Except the man standing right beside him with his medical bag was the doctor. And I don't want to be graphic, but you're in Alaska and you can probably handle it. The doctor, and this is, again, I'm not trying to be graphic, but it's my favorite part of the story. The doctor says he pulled out his finger and he put his finger in the hole to try to stop the bleeding as he's telling, like, he goes on, I'm not giving you more, but he goes on, saves this dude's life. It's amazing. Well, who was this young officer? He ended up becoming a pretty famous person. Have you ever seen the famous painting of Washington crossing the Delaware? He's actually the one behind George Washington holding the American flag. Again, well, who is he? His name is James Monroe. He went on to become the fifth president of the United States. And this is where people begin looking and they're like, okay, so you're telling me that we're going to have this incredible force, outnumber them, and then we can't get across the river except with 2,400. So our force has been dwindled. I mean, it reminds me of Bible stories. And I think of Gideon, right? He's trying to get this big army and God's like, that's too many. You don't need that many. So he only has 2,400 men. There's no way they're going to make it in time. A blizzard comes in. God, why is there a blizzard? Well, the guards are now off duty. Nobody's there. You show up. And now when it starts, they leave their entrenched position to come fight you in the open area, and the battle lasts 35 minutes, and you wound and kill and capture almost all of them, and they only wound three, and the only one that had what would be considered a fatal wound, the doctor standing right beside him, because the only dog that barked that night happened to be the dog of the doctor. I mean, literally, they're going through this, and they're like, that doesn't seem normal. Right? Like, I think maybe God was helping us. And this is actually where, if you go back and read their writings, George Washington talked about God's providence in this battle. In fact, through the Revolution, Washington wrote on 250 occasions in his letters about God's providence throughout the Revolution. This is just one of those moments where he writes about God intervening for them and helping them. But remember General Henry Knox? He was the one actually in charge of that crossing where we got troops across. Here's part of the letter he wrote about that morning. He said, the hurry, fright, and confusion of the enemy was not unlike that which will be when the last trump will sound. Referencing when Paul's writing about the return of Christ, right? And the chaos and the craziness, he's like, that's how it felt that morning. It was just crazy what was going on. He concluded this thought saying, providence seemed to have smiled upon every part of this enterprise. Recognizing God showed up and God helped. Well, this is what happened through the whole revolution. So much so that if you go just a little over a year later, George Washington in 1778 writes General Thomas Nelson Jr. a letter. And in this letter, he acknowledges how obvious it's been that God's been moving on their behalf. He said, the hand of providence has been so conspicuous in all this that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith and more than wicked that has not gratitude enough to acknowledge his obligations. Meaning, if you're seeing everything we're seeing, if you can't acknowledge that God's been moving on our behalf, you have to have no faith at all, or you must be wicked if you can't acknowledge what God has done. Well, his next line in the letter is my favorite. His next line, he says, but it will be time enough for me to turn preacher when my present appointment ceases, and therefore I shall add no more on the doctrine of providence. Washington's like, I've seen enough miracles, I could become a pastor. But for right now, I'm going to focus on my present appointment, winning the war. I'm going to win the war first, and then we'll figure out being a pastor later, okay? This is how obvious it was to them that God was moving on their behalf. Now, this is only a sample because this happens through the whole revolution. Well, let me give you the conclusion. If you jump to the end of the revolution finally officially, legally finishes when you have the Peace Treaty of Paris. The three Americans that signed the Peace Treaty of Paris, on the left is John Jay, in the middle is John Adams, on the right is Benjamin Franklin. The Peace Treaty of Paris is still in Washington, D.C., on display in the State Department. It's up on the sixth floor. It's called the John Quincy Adams State Drawing Room. And if you look on the left, you see up on the top, there's 10 articles. If you come down the bottom left, you see David Hartley with the blue ribbon, British ambassador. But then you see John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay. If you look at the top right, now, this is the document that ended the American Revolution, brought peace between us and Great Britain, established America as a free and independent nation. Look at the title of the document. In the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. Do you know America became a nation in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit? It's literally on top of the document. Now, we could ask, how many of you saw that in your history books? And I know none of you did. Because even though this is a literal government document, see, we don't tell these stories anymore. We think today that America was birthed as a secular nation and that the founding fathers, they didn't want God to be a part. No, no. These were people that knew without God's help, we will never succeed in what we are trying to accomplish. Right? And to go further, why would you, this is the title of a peace treaty. That is a super weird title for a peace treaty. Oh, it is. But it's possible somebody had read Proverbs 3 recently. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your steps. They literally acknowledged him on the top of the document that made America a nation. The reason, again, I point this out is because if we actually knew the story of how America became a nation, it makes a lot more sense what John Adams wrote Thomas Jefferson in 1813, that the principles upon which we did this, they were the principles of Christianity. This was the foundation of the nation. And if you even go forward a little bit, when George Washington becomes president, at the end of his presidency, he, in 1796, he delivers what was known as his farewell address, considered the most significant political address ever given by a president in American history. In this, he was giving advice to America for how to succeed in the future going forward. Let me read you part of what he wrote. He said, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity. Now, let me highlight the fact, political prosperity, we're talking about a nation, a government to succeed. For a government to succeed, he says, of all the things you can do which lead to political prosperity, he said, religion and morality are indispensable supports. An indispensable support means you cannot do it without this. Like this is the beam holding up the ceiling, right? Like this, you cannot do it without this. Then he continued. He said, in vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars. The people that are against religion and morality, he says, they don't love their nation. Because that's what a patriot is. A patriot loves their nation. He says, people that oppose religion and morality, they don't love America. Now, why would he say that? Well, they knew something that we've really forgotten in much of our culture. See, the following year, John Adams, when he became president, he then writes a letter to the militia of Massachusetts. And in this letter, he follows up on this thought. He says, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. Our nation was built a certain way. It only works with religion and morality. Why? Because part of the idea of the Constitution is we want to live in freedom, right? We, the people, are in charge. We don't need some government, some dictator telling us what to do. Our rights don't come from government. They come from God. There was an idea behind this nation. But what they knew is this idea only works if you have a moral people. Why? Because freedom only works with moral people. If you give freedom to immoral people, it looks like Chicago on any given weekend. Right? I mean, genuinely, like there was 100 people shot and 20 that died just like 2 weekends ago. That's not going to work for freedom in a nation. But the problem right now is we think, well, we need to pass all these different laws. No, maybe the problem is we've lost religion and morality. Because let me walk you through this. This is the way our nation always was. It wasn't until the 1960s that the U.S. Supreme Court first, in a case, Engle versus Vitale, in 1962, the U.S. Supreme Court said, you know, we don't think it's appropriate to have prayer in schools anymore. This is the first time that was ever talked about. And they had no historic precedent to cite. They said, we just think prayer shouldn't be there. We should have a separation of church and state, meaning we should secularize anything the government funds. Well, the following year, there was a dual decision. It was Abington Shimp and Murray Curlett. And this year, the Supreme Court said, also, we shouldn't teach the Bible in schools anymore. We should remove the Bible from schools. And when the Supreme Court delivered their decision on why we should remove the Bible from schools, they actually quoted a psychologist who had testified about the dangers of kids reading the Bible in school. Now, what would be the danger? Well, here's the quote they wrote in their decision. If portions of the New Testament were read without explanation, they could be and had been psychologically harmful to the child. So if a kid were to read the Bible, it might cause psychological harm. That's brain damage, right? If kids were to read the Bible. Now, here's what's crazy to me. As someone who loves, reads, studies, and knows the Bible, this is crazy for lots of reasons, but let me start with the first crazy. They said if portions of the New Testament were read. You think the New Testament has the bad parts? I don't think you've read the whole thing. Right? Like if there are some parts in the Bible that are not kid-friendly, it's not the new part. Let's be clear on that. But in their decision, the psychologist explained the two dangers of the New Testament. He said, for students to learn about Jesus wouldn't be good because that might offend some students, say that Jesus is the only way. And then second, and when I was reading this, I was like, what else are you going to argue? Like, this is crazy to me. He said, and the psychologist, and I'm reading this, the psychologist said, and in the book of Revelation, and I was like, okay, this might be fair. Like, Revelation could be intense. No. He said in Revelation, it talks about the torment and the fires of hell, and we wouldn't want kids to be fearful of hell. And I was like, I do. Right? Like, I want you to know, you don't want to go there, right? Like, you should be scared of that place. Literally, the reason the Bible was removed, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, was because of Jesus and because of hell. We didn't want kids to know about Jesus and hell. That's when the Bible was removed. Now, that's the way it's been for the last 60 years in our nation up until there's been a change. Because one of the things that happened, in the First Amendment, the Lemon decision was in 1971, because after this started, there was a lot of people saying, hey, we do a lot of other religious things, like in our government, in our schools. We should stop all of those. Like, we shouldn't have kids praying at football games. We shouldn't have kids praying at their valedictorian or salutatorian speeches. We shouldn't have nativity scenes. We shouldn't sing Christmas carols. They start going after everything they viewed to be Christian. And what happens, the Supreme Court, in the case Lemon v. Kurtzman, says, we should have a test that we can use to apply to see if something is permissible to do in government institutions. It was known as the Lemon Test. And the Lemon Test, there was a three-pronged test to it, but essentially, the number one issue they said is that for religious activity to be permitted in government settings, its primary purpose has to be secular. What religious activity's primary purpose is secular? None. And therefore, they said, so no religious activity is allowed anymore. Even if there's historic precedent, we're not doing it because it's not secular. Well, that's the way it was up until a couple years ago when there got to be a new makeup on the Supreme Court. And actually, it was really cool. The Supreme Court read this really old document called the Constitution. And they recognized that, hey, the Constitution doesn't say this. And over a series of several years, first of all, in 2019, there was a case to the Supreme Court. It was a Bladensburg Cross decision. And there was a World War I memorial cross where there was a group of mothers who had lost their sons in World War I. And they got together and they erected this memorial cross in honor of their sons who had died in World War I. And there was an atheist who came by and said, that cross offends me, and sued to have the cross taken down. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And by the way, it lost at every single level up until the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, in the case of American Legion versus Humanist Association, this is where the Supreme Court came out and they said, okay, we clearly are having people misunderstand what we should be doing. And part of what they said in their decision, they said, the reason that people are saying we can't have a cross up is because they're citing the Lemon Test and they're saying that the primary purpose of this cross was not secular, therefore we should take it down. They said, we should change that thought. They said, long-standing religiously expressive monuments, symbols, and practices require a strong presumption of constitutionality. They said, we're going to have a new standard. And the new standard is, if we've done something for like hundreds of years, we should assume it's probably okay. Right? Like, if all the founding fathers thought it was okay, we should probably think it's okay. So if there's a long-standing historic tradition
there should be a presumption of constitutionality. Now, that was the first one, and this was the first chink in the armor, so to speak, of the Lemon Test. Well, then, just a couple years later, there was, oh, by the way, it shifts the presumption of constitutionality. Instead of saying if it's religious, we shouldn't do it, to saying if we've done it forever, it's probably okay. Well, from this ripple effect, one of the things that happens is in 2022 in Boston, there's three flagpoles outside of City Hall in Boston. And one of them is the American flag, one is the city flag, and then on the third flag, they will let anybody from the town take out a petition and they can fly their flag. They flew over 200 flags, and there was a group, a constitutional group, and they said, hey, we want to fly the Christian flag. And Boston said, oh, no, that's offensive. You can fly any flag but that one, but you can't fly the Christian flag. This went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, interestingly, in the case Shurtleff versus City of Boston, it was a 9-0 decision. Even like the leftist liberals were like, that's kind of crazy, it's too far. Justice Stephen Breyer said, the Lemon decision was issued during a bygone era when this court took a more free-willing approach to interpreting legal text. He said, that era is over. Even the liberal justice said, yeah, we recognize that was kind of crazy what we did, and we're not doing that anymore. So in a 9-0 decision, the city of Boston was told, no, if somebody petitions to fly the Christian flag, you cannot tell them no, you have to fly the Christian flag. Well, then the last case that changed everything was the Coach Kennedy decision. If you're not familiar with Coach Kennedy, he was a football coach from Bremerton, Washington, who at the end of a football game, he would go to the 50-yard line by himself, kneel down, and quietly pray, not even out loud, and he was fired for doing so at the end of the football game. It took 7 years for his case to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, when they finally heard his decision, it was Kennedy versus Bremerton School District. When they heard the decision, they said, okay, the reason he was fired was because of the Lemon Test, saying, well, he's clearly doing something religious. It's not for secular purposes. So he got fired. And the Supreme Court said, okay, we are forever done with the Lemon Test because that was wrong from its inception, and it's been used as a club against people of faith. We are getting rid of that test and we will never use it again. But what's even more impressive is over the last 50 years, the Lemon Test was used on more than 7,300 occasions in federal court to stop religious activity. Why does that matter? Because the Supreme Court said Lemon's overturned, which means that all 7,300 of those things we were told we couldn't do are now back on the table, okay? I want to close by giving you this challenge. What do we do now? Well, one of the things we read in Proverbs, it says, the wise man attacks the city of the mighty and tears down the stronghold. What does a wise man do? A wise man attacks a stronghold, right? That means that we need to be offensive-minded, because for a lot of years as Christians, we've said, hey, let's not offend anybody. Let's just kind of be cool with everybody. Okay, I get that Jesus, super loving person, most loving person you're ever going to meet. Yeah. There's more to Jesus than that, though, right? Like, we can talk, like, if you don't remember, like, go to the Gospel of John. That dude braided a whip, right? Like, he had some backbone when he needed it, but here's what I want to point out. If all you ever do is play defense, all you will ever do is slow down how fast the other side goes, okay? And when you have people that hate Christianity, that hate God, that hate America, and all we do is let them go on offense, and we just try to slow them down, we are slowly ceding culture over to people that hate God and hate our nation. As opposed to, right now, there's never been a better time to advance religious freedom and even Christianity in America, legally speaking, than right now. Let me walk you back. So First Liberty is the one that had all of these cases to the U.S. Supreme Court. They had four cases to the U.S. Supreme Court in the last 5 years, and they won them all. And some of the things that now that have changed are, for example, the Ten Commandments. If you're not familiar, 2 weeks ago, the governor of Louisiana signed a law that requires all public schools to once again display the Ten Commandments. Because the only reason Ten Commandments ever came down in public schools was in 1980, there was a case, Stone v. Graham, where the U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, the Lemon Test says you can't have religious things for religious reasons. The only reason you're showing the Ten Commandments is for religious reasons, therefore we're taking it down. Well, that has now been struck down. So now every single school, and by the way, that means teachers too, okay? If you are a teacher, if you have kids in public school, every single school can now once again display the Ten Commandments. And we're actually working with state legislators to help make that happen. Memorial crosses are now acceptable in any kind of cemetery, any kind of federal area. You can put up crosses. Those are now, nobody can say, you're not allowed to do that. That's religious. Nope, we're allowed to do that because the only reason we were ever told not to is a Lemon Test, and that's been struck down. That is gone. It's not here anymore. Well, we also can point to things like public invocations. Any meeting that you ever attend, government meeting, can now open with prayer. All that has to happen is somebody has to say, hey, can we open this with prayer? It is now constitutional, whether it be a school board, whether it be a city council, whether it be a governor's meeting, anything federally oriented that we were told we couldn't pray, that's now legal again. And even nativity scenes in Christmas carols in schools. For a while, we were told, hey, you can't really put up nativity scenes. And the workaround was people said, well, what if we put up like Santa and Rudolph? Because then, like, it's just a big Christmas celebration. And court said, well, yeah, if it's not about Jesus, then you can do it. But if it's about Jesus, you can't. The only reason, and by the way, I'm not like super anti like Santa and Rudolph, right? But I'm just pointing out, the only reason that those ever became a primary part of American Christmas celebrations over the last 50 and 60 years is it was a compromise Christians made to be able to put up nativity scenes. You don't have to compromise anymore, right? Now, if you want to still have up St. Nick, that's great. I'm not anti-St. Nick. I'm just saying that in schools, we can have nativity scenes in libraries, government buildings, courthouses. Those all can go back. And even schools, we're told, yeah, and you know, at school Christmas choirs, you're not allowed to sing like Joy to the World or Angels We've Heard on High. Those are religious, only like Jingle Bells. Literally, courts were saying you couldn't sing Christian carols. Well, again, that's been struck down. So we can actually once again begin teaching kids, whose birthday are we celebrating at Christmas? It's Jesus, right? Why do we have a Christmas break? It's Jesus. This is the reason we do this. That can be done again. And to go a little further, even in God We Trust displays, there are now over 7,000 counties in the United States that have adopted this as their county motto. This is a national motto, but this now can go up in every county. It's why sometimes you'll see even police vehicles, depending on where you live and where you travel, you'll see different departments that will have in God We Trust put up on their vehicles or in their city, and even student-led prayer. Do you know right now that every single class in public school can begin with prayer as long as a student leads it? And if a student asks the principal to pray and the principal tells them no, they can challenge it based on religious discrimination and speech discrimination, and they can win. And this is where going back to, if you are older than like 50 or 60 years old, you probably remember at times when we prayed in school. We prayed at football games before a Friday night game. Like, this was a normal thing. We can make it normal again. We can once again restore having prayer in schools. And here's also an interesting one. The Bible course is now being taught in public schools around the nation, where the only textbook that students are reading in this course is the Bible. And this is not just for literature, it's also a history book, but this is actually being done in public schools. This can be done again in public schools up here in Alaska. And also the idea of balanced science treatment. For decades, we have been teaching kids, well, it's just from goo to you. That's the only possibility. No, there's another idea of where we came from. And we actually now can give the same amount of time to teaching creation that we do to teaching evolution. According to the U.S. Supreme Court, as long as it's balanced, you can talk about all of it. Say, now kids, some people think like Darwin, goo to you. Some people think that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? We literally can return that and do that in schools. And the reason, I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg, but the reason I'm telling you this is because right now, there are religious liberty law firms all over America, their only job is to defend Christianity, to defend religious liberty, the First Amendment for groups, and they do it for free. They say if somebody has the courage to step up, they have donors that fund them, and we will represent you for free. If you have the courage to do it, we're going to help you succeed. Why I'm telling you that is because where we are now, we have more opportunity than we've seen in any of our lifetimes to once again begin advancing Christianity in our nation, restoring the religious and moral foundation that lets America succeed as a nation, and helping our kids once again, even in schools, learn about God and Jesus, learning about the creation story. And as I finish, I want to give you the thought of being offensive minded, but now I want to give you one more thought of it being long term, because whether we talk about if we're going to look at city councils or school boards or municipality, water district, public board, right? I mean, there's so many areas we can get involved and try to restore some of this. Let me give you now a different perspective. In the American Revolution, when you have the first major battles as it unfolds in 1775, you have the Battle of Lexington Green, top right, you have the Battle of Concord Bridge, top left. Bottom left, you have the Battle on the Road Back to Boston. Bottom right, you have the Battle of Bunker Hill. As the American Revolution unfolds, what's interesting is as this happens, nobody called for George Washington. What happened is, as there were battles in local areas, it was the local pastor who challenged the people from his church, you better stand up and we better stop what's going on. Literally, Lexington Green, the Reverend Jonas Clark, had more than 80 men from his church. The Battle of Concord, at Concord Bridge, it was the Reverend William Emerson, had 300 men from his church that went out. The battle on the road back to Boston, there were 4,000 to 5,000 Americans that opposed the British, and historians identify there were dozens of pastors that were not only leading their congregation, as they would go through towns, they would call other men from the town to come and join them to go oppose the British. When you get to the Battle of Bunker Hill, there were 600 men that the local pastor had helped raise to be in two companies to oppose the British. It's interesting that as we look so often at the crisis in our nation, we look for who are the national heroes who can save the day. And we have elections coming up. And oftentimes, even as Christians, we're like, who can we elect to solve our problems? Not that I am not supportive of maybe changing some leaders in areas, right? But understand, if you change politicians, all politicians can do is slow down the decay of culture unless the church gets involved. Politicians cannot restore religion and morality. Politicians can't reintroduce a culture and a nation to Jesus. What makes a difference is the church. And by the way, even if you look at George Washington, the fact that the majority of the American Revolution was fought on the local level, and just to give you that idea, in the American Revolution, there's more than 250 battles in the American Revolution. George Washington fought in 17, and he only won 6. We lost the majority of battles in the American Revolution, but we won the war because we kept showing up. Don't think to turn a culture around, you just got to fight one battle and we win. Nope. You got to fight year after year. You might lose some battles, but if you keep showing up, we know who wins the war, right? This is my encouragement to you. Our nation was built on religion and morality. It was built with God moving and God doing miracles. Without God's help, there never would have been an American nation. And without God's help, we won't keep an American nation, right? But also why that matters is because that means we can't just look for political solutions and look for a national leader to solve our problems. I don't know. Going back to even our name, wall builders, comes from the Bible book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is the one that wanted to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem after they'd been torn down. People told Nehemiah, there's no way you can do that. It's too hard, right? It's too big of a task. And he said, I just want anybody that's willing, the whosoever wills, come with me. Let's go inside the city. Everybody live here and just start building in your own backyard. When everybody built in their own backyard, the wall was completed in 52 days. If we just thought about building in our own backyard, do you know in every community there's at least one church? And if every church just said, you know what, we're going to take care of our backyard. We're going to take care of the local things where we are. We're going to make a difference where we are. If every church said where God has planted us, we're going to reach our community. Every community gets reached, and in record time, we can rebuild the foundation, the morals that we have lost in our nation. And if you guys want to know more about these stories, we have a lot at Wall Builders. We have several resources on wallbuilders.com, but we have two books where we tell a lot of these stories. There's more than 1,000 footnotes in the back of each of those. We also even have another resource called the Founder's Bible, where in the Founder's Bible, it's a normal Bible, which is the most important thing to read. It's the Bible itself. But in it, we actually go through the Founder's writings, and every time they quoted or reference a Bible verse, we put their quote by the verse they're referencing, and there's thousands of them. So that as you read the Bible, you can literally see how the founding fathers are quoting, well, we use this verse to shape public policy here. We use this verse in the Constitution. We use this verse. And so literally seeing how the Bible shaped America. And part of why that matters is because Christians are the only ones who have even a chance to change things in this nation. Because the Bible says that righteousness exalts a nation. Now, the slogan, make America great again, I think it's a pretty good slogan. You can only make her great again if you know what made her great in the first place. And the Bible says it's righteousness that exalts a nation. Christians are the only hope for the future of any nation. And by the way, this is not just like a pro-American message. This is a pro-Christian message. Because if you read Jeremiah 29, most people know verse 11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you, not to harm you, give you hope in a future. Most people know that verse. Yeah, back up to verse 5, where Jeremiah tells the people, hey, don't despair because you're captivity and you're in bondage. Don't stop getting married. Don't stop raising kids, having families. Don't stop planting crops. He said, instead, seek the peace and prosperity of the land in which I've carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it. For when it goes well with the land, it goes well with you. You might not even like the place where God had planted you. But he said, you need to seek the best for it. You need to pray for it. You need to work to make things better, because when you work to make things better, you can enjoy those blessings and benefits as well. This is the reality of being Christians. We've been called to be salt and light wherever God's planted us, right? So, and again, I'm referencing this. This is not a pro-America message. This is a Christian message. It's understanding our call as Christians, that we need to be found faithful in what God has called us to do, being fruitful where God has planted us. And the only hope for this nation is for Christians to once again recognize that we have to be the solution. We have to be the salt and light. And there's never been a better opportunity than now. If we will have the courage and go on offense, we can make a difference. Pastor, let me give it back to you.
Well, that was really good. Well, I want to do just a couple things before we end. If there's one thing I learned from that, it all starts with prayer. Amen. Can we just pray for our nation real quick? Lord, we come on behalf of our nation, Lord, and not only our nation, but our state and our local governments, God, that you would intervene, Lord, and that you would raise Christians up to take these roles, that you would raise people up to vote and raise people up to just stand for what is right and true, and not only stand, but to advance. Lord, as we advance in the name of Jesus to tear down the walls and things that people that don't know you have erected. So we just want to rebuke the plan of the enemy in the name of Jesus over our nation, over our state, and over our city. In the name of Jesus, be broken off. Lord, and we just surrender to your will and what your ways want. God, we ask that you would protect our leaders, that you would just be in charge of everything as we know that you are God, but we surrender to your will. We ask all this in your holy name, Jesus. We have a lot of stuff going on outside this morning, and we want to invite you that you're welcome to come to our Founders Day picnic. And so we're going to have a lot of fun with that. And then if you are a guest here, I'd love to meet you over here through these doors. And then also, if you don't know Jesus, this is the most important thing you'll hear all day. If you don't know Jesus, or if you have any other thing that you need prayer on, we would love to meet you right here and see that need met. Amen? Amen. Well, God bless you. Buy a book from Brother Tim, and let's have some fun outside as we celebrate what God has done. Amen.